I'm Connor Cyrus, one of the hosts of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. We saved you some time to get it right, so you only have the good stuff. I hope you enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. Today on the show, we're going to explore the cutting-edge technology of artificial intelligence and its impact on our daily lives. From virtual assistants to automated driving, AI is changing the way we live and work. In healthcare, AI is helping doctors diagnose and treat patients faster and more accurately. In retail, AI is improving the shopping experience for customers. Today on Vermont Edition, we're excited to talk about one of the most advanced AI models out there, ChatGPT. Developed by OpenAI, ChatGPT is a large language model capable of understanding and responding to natural language inputs. We'll talk about how ChatGPT can be used to automate tasks, improve customer service, and even create new forms of entertainment. Tune in to learn more about how artificial intelligence is shaping our world and how we use it to make our lives better. Now, that introduction I just read was written by ChatGPT with the prompt, write 10 radio sentences talking about artificial intelligence and how we use it. Make one sentence about ChatGPT and use the phrase today on Vermont Edition. So listeners, my questions to you, do you think that that's a sign of how AI is going to transform our world? Or are you unimpressed that AI like ChatGPT can generate radio scripts, resumes, or even homework assignments? Our first guest today is from the state's AI task force, and he's going to tell us about the state's role in working with and creating guidance on AI. Josiah Reich, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, I'm really glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So Josiah, let's just get started with, how do you explain AI?
Yeah, so I think people talk about a lot of different ideas when they use the term AI. So this is a great spot to start. It's generally used to describe machines and technologies that do things we usually consider humans to be good at and computers to struggle with. So things like learning and making decisions. AI problems generally boil down to two big concepts. The first one is predicting what comes next in a sequence. And then the other one is classifying things, so sorting things into categories. If you think about like a self-driving car, it's doing both kinds of those tasks all the time. It's looking at the world around it and classifying each object it sees into a category and then predicting the next thing that that object is going to do. Like trees are going to stay still, a pedestrian or a car might take a certain action, and then it's predicting what it should do to respond to that environment. If you're thinking about ChatGPT, it's first classifying the prompt to figure out what your intent is, what you're trying to get out of it, and then predicting a set of words to accomplish that. And when computer scientists talk about AI, they're usually talking about machine learning, where instead of telling a computer like birds are generally above you and have feathers, they're giving a computer a lot of examples of birds and saying like, here's a bird, this thing's not a bird, and letting the computer make adjustments to its internals until it gets the answer right consistently.
So you're one of the chairs of the state's AI task force. Tell us about when it was created and why.
Yeah, so I'm actually the director of artificial intelligence for the state. The task force was organized back in 2018 by legislature to make some recommendations on how the state should proceed with AI. They submitted their final report in 2020. And then last year, the legislature stood up two new AI bodies in the state. One is the Division of AI within the Agency of Digital Services, and that's what I'm the director of. And then also an AI council with the goal of providing advice and guidance to the division. And really, legislature gave us like two big goals. One is ensuring that the state adopts and uses AI thoughtfully in ways that maximize the potential benefits while avoiding all the potential harms that are out there. And then the other is giving Vermont a leadership role among states in crafting how we will work with AI technology.
So as you said, it's a fairly new task force. Tell us what you've been able to accomplish so far.
Yeah, so if I can frame what we've been able to accomplish with some observations on like what's hard about AI, we just talked about how like it's really good at predicting the next thing that will come in a sequence, but it's not necessarily good at being truthful or honest. So if you ask GPT to write marketing materials for a perpetual motion machine, right, something that could not possibly exist, it will cheerfully do that, not caring that it's like making stuff up. And so there's some challenges in that, in use for government specifically, where we really do care about truthfulness a lot. Other things that tend to pop up with AI is they're really, like ChatGPT is trained using material that humans have written. And a lot of it is older material. So the biases and the perspectives of people who wrote books back in the 18 and 1900s are useful for historical context, but sometimes creep into AI in unexpected ways. So those are two challenges that we face. And so we've developed a code of ethics for how we're going to apply AI in the state. And we've specifically laid out ways that it should and shouldn't be used. So we're looking for using AIs in ways that maintain freedoms and liberties of Vermonters, are transparent, and help to maintain trust in Vermont's institutions, in ways that deliver services better to Vermonters, and that are human-centric and make work more creative and meaningful for both Vermonters and their public servants.
So why was it
also said, like,
I'm just gonna jump in here. And why was it important for that to be your first task, was to create an ethics policy?
So there are a lot of companies out there like starting to use AI in ways that we thought could be problematic. In China, for example, AI is really broadly used to monitor individuals and see what they're doing. And certain companies have adopted AI in ways that are really not centered around people. They're really focused on just efficiency. And those things are problematic from our perspective, both for like in the case of China's surveillance state, right? That's not the world we want to live in. And in the case of companies that are just building AI to focus on efficiency, it really dehumanizes the work that people are doing and treats the people basically like they're part of the machinery to get something done. And we think that that's not the approach that we want to take in state government or in Vermont companies broadly.
Are there specific rules or bans about using AI in Vermont that the task force wants to put into law?
We've put some things for now in our draft policy, and it is still a draft. And if people have feedback on it, you can find it in the legislative reports on the legislature's website. And feel free to hit me up if you have feedback. At this point, we haven't made any recommendations for laws. But in the policy, you'll see we've defined some ways that like we don't want AI used. So anything that monitors or limits the free exercise of rights, anything that's creating like whole new capabilities for government, we want to avoid. We're trying to avoid any AI implementation where it could make a decision that has a big impact on a Vermonter or a group of Vermonters. And also avoiding AI that creates confusion about who's responsible for the decision that gets made or the roles of the people involved in using the system.
And listeners, we will put a link to that draft on our website, vermontpublic.org. I want to know, how are state agencies using AI now?
Yeah, so there's only a few places that are using AI today. So they fall into kind of three big buckets, and there's a report about this on legislature too, because we're government and we're good at reports. We have one set of AI solutions that's focused on maintaining physical infrastructure. So we use imagery that we collect in what's called right-of-way surveys. Basically, there's a truck that drives down the road with a camera pointing down onto the road and marks out like road sections that are in bad shape. So like infrastructure, things of that nature, things about looking at like watersheds and where runoff goes, using AI in that solution. We're using it to monitor our IT infrastructure and make recommendations to keep our costs low within the Agency of Digital Services, and to improve our security by doing threat detection. And then also we have some AI systems that are really focused on improving efficiency. Like there's a lot of paperwork that goes on in the state, as you can imagine. So sorting and routing documents and things like that to improve efficiency.
And as we're talking about improving efficiencies, where would you like to see, and where would the task force like to see AI in the future? And how do you want it used? I know, you know, you've obviously talked about wanting to improve people's lives, but what does that look like in terms of practical use?
Yeah, so there's like three big ideas that we're exploring right now. One is just generally speeding up and improving the quality of service that Vermont's able to provide to Vermonters. So things like automatically handling easy cases. If you apply for a benefit that has a similar set of requirements to one you've already applied for, can we just like fast track that using AI and get that done so that it streamlines that process? Another one is eliminating paperwork. So a lot of our processes boil down to like check a bunch of boxes and then write some sort of narrative that really covers a lot of the same thing in the boxes. And could we use AI to improve that? And I think we've been looking at some possibilities there where we could take just the narrative part that's written and fill out all the rest of the documentation. We think that this will help Vermonters who maybe don't speak English as their first language to access our services better. And also internally, if you think of like EMS workers and police officers and folks like that who spend a lot of time like doing something and then writing a report about it, if we can take away some of the administrative burden from them using AI, we can free up some of those really overtaxed individuals to do more of the things that they love, helping Vermonters, and a little bit less time sitting at a computer doing paperwork.
That's and just, then, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and then the third one is like trying to find ways to help Vermont businesses be pioneers in the AI space. So we don't have a program stood up for this yet, it's still early days, but we've been doing a lot of work on learning how to apply AI in effective and ways that support people's humanity and the dignity of work. And we want to share that with Vermont businesses and help them to jumpstart their own use of AI.
That's Josiah Raich. He's the director of AI for the state, and he's also on the state's task force. Josiah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now we're going to move to the pros and cons of AI in the classroom. Now, for some, there's two main schools of thought when it comes to how AI is incorporated in the classroom. Some think we should crack down on it and discourage its use, while others say we should explore how to use it and help make student learning better. It's important for schools and colleges to carefully consider the potential benefits and drawbacks of using AI in education and to take steps to ensure that technology is used responsibly. Our next guest is Professor Brian Glennie. He's the Associate Professor of Philosophy who teaches the ethics of artificial intelligence at Norwich University. Brian, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, Brian, how did you get started in the discussion of AI? Specifically, you teach about ethics of it. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. I work in what's called philosophy of mind. And so we think a lot about intelligence. And I guess this particular large language model, ChatGPT, is the most intelligent, if you will, of all of these large language models. So to teach a class on AI ethics gives us an opportunity to kind of look in more detail at what these machines are. Are they actually intelligent? Oh my gosh, I'm a philosopher, so you gotta work with me a little bit here.
All right, let's go there.
Okay,
let's go. That's what the show's about.
Okay, we can ask questions about whether or not they might attain some kind of sentience, some kind of feeling, and whether or not they might qualify as being what philosophers like to call sapient. That kind of means that they have the ability to understand, to have what we might call wisdom. So, I mean, the question is kind of an open field, and it provides a lot of grist for the mill. Students get really excited in thinking and adventuring into these ideas. And so, should we do a little bit of it? I mean,
when you're talking about, and you specifically when it comes to students who are learning and kind of have a general sense of what AI is and how it's incorporated into their lives, they might not know that it's AI specifically, but they know. How do you begin to teach them the ethics of this? Like, is it right to use it? Is it wrong to use it? Is it actually smart? How do you begin those conversations?
I mean, we could start the way that you started, right? We can ask ChatGPT. If we pop it in, it will actually respond that it thinks it understands various natural language, grammar, spelling, punctuation. And so it gives us an opportunity to think about, like, what does it mean to actually understand something, right? How reflective is this machine actually being? And in what senses are we similar to it or different from it? So, of course, you have these general questions, but let's look at the day-to-day. Let's take, for instance, this amazing ability of prediction that Josiah was talking about. When I have ads pop up Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, it's shocking at how good they are at predicting what I'm thinking about, what I'm looking at. It's so powerful. My students are convinced that there's like a little mic in their iPhones or in their computers listening to them and then automatically telling you know, the browser or the social media what kind of ads to show. But in fact, this is just predictive processing. That's all it is.
I just have to like take a step back because I am in the school of thought that Big Brother is listening to my phone. So you're just telling me that it's really just a really smart algorithm.
Yeah, correct. I mean, just this morning I had something pop up about cat food. I mentioned to my daughter, "Yo, we need to get some cat food," and my gosh, I was like, "Is it listening to me?" No. It just turns out like every 5 weeks, we need cat food in this house.
Interesting. I'm not fully convinced that Big Brother's not listening, but I do think that that's an interesting way to go. Now, what are some other artificial intelligence people are using right now in their everyday lives? Like where else is this kind of tech already being used?
Yeah, so I think we have, you know, the grammar and spelling check services, you know, Word definitely uses it. Grammarly, pretty much every high school student, I mean, is dependent upon this.
I am one of those people.
I know, same here. Okay, I'll say it, I'll admit. Certainly, you know, facial recognition to open my iPhone. There's like really important uses aside from these like common uses, like diagnosing cancer. I mean, it turns out AI is really, really good at looking at x-rays and finding the patterns of cancer, so to speak, or its symptoms. Stoplight management, I think in big cities, it helps control traffic. Of course, streaming services, it kind of gives us movies that it thinks we would that we would like. And honestly, what I use a lot of it for is plagiarism detection, strangely enough.
I want to go to the phones, and I want to talk to Mish from Norwich. Mish, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be on the show. Very brief comment and a very interesting discussion. Thank you, Professor. So from Norwich, I'm an emeritus professor of computer science, and I taught the course Politics of Cyberspace for over a decade that included a section on artificial intelligence. Just a quick warning, when we are talking about the kinds of programs that produce information or controls, we have to distinguish between those that have what is called a world model integrated into the programming versus those that don't. Now, an example of a perfectly normal, if you want to call it artificial intelligence, is, for example, an industrial control system or supervisory control and data acquisition system, such as an insulin pump in a hospital. That program has very strict rules on how much insulin can be administered to a patient, depending on the blood glucose level, the previous dosages, and so on. That's called a world model. It is constraints. ChatGPT is an associative model, as our colleague has mentioned a few minutes ago. It's an associative model, but it has no world model. It is entirely dependent on the input that generates the statistical associations, the correlations among symbols, words, words, sentences, paragraphs, phrases, and so on. But it does not have any way of telling, and thus blocking, that what it has generated is total nonsense. And as you read the literature on ChatGPT in particular, there are lots of examples where the program has been fed disinformation or misinformation available widely on the World Wide Web, and it generates nonsense.
I think we got it. And so, Brian, I want to take this question to you. When it comes to these AI models that are not worldly, I want to know how we provide safeguards or guardrails to make sure that the information that we're getting is accurate.
Well, I mean, I think just like anything from the internet, we have to provide, critically reflect on the information it's telling us. And I think this kind of leads into ways in which we might use ChatGPT in our evaluation of students' learning. Rather than just forbidding its use, you can ask it a question and have it as a prompt, and then students can criticize various aspects of it that are true or that are false. It can lead them on these little rabbit trails to find resources or other references that support or undermine the claims of ChatGPT. I mean, I have a really strange research area right now where I'm studying this really unique sensory modality in a fish in Japan that can pick up like differences in pH. And ChatGPT does not think that's possible, even though there's legitimate papers that show that it is. And so this is an opportunity again for learning rather than just literally rote copy and pasting and submitting it as an assignment. And so I think this is the move that a lot of educators, I hope, will start to make as they realize actually the benefits where, it's not the professor that's wrong anymore, that the students are able to criticize and show up, but rather it's this autonomous software that, students can use as kind of like a plaything, as it were, to kind of create a learning environment, learning experience.
I think you've told us a little bit, but how have you incorporated this and how do you plan to incorporate ChatGPT into the classroom as it becomes more advanced, right? This is kind of like an alpha or beta model of this particular form of AI. And we all know that these things tend to get bigger and better. Is that how you see it? And if so, how do you plan on continuing it in your classroom?
No, I mean, this is the creator, Sam Altman. He suggested maybe watermarking or producing another kind of software that can detect when it's being used. But even he says this has limited capacity because ChatGPT is in its infant stage and it will learn more and be better to the point where it could perhaps beat any of these, softwares that can tell the difference between the use of AI and a human. So I think I mean, he's trying to suggest that schools should not just be outlawing this. And by the way, you know, Seattle Public Schools and New York Public Schools have outlawed it for their secondary ed and elementary. But I don't think universities and colleges should do that. I think that they should say, look, we need new strategies, new evaluative techniques that don't sideline ChatGPT, but make it participate in our learning experiences. And again, I think I mentioned one of them. You just ask a student to perhaps take on a prompt of ChatGPT and then edit it down and maybe show using word review all of the different changes that it's made, both grammatically, et cetera, better word use so it's not so boring, and then adding references. There, by the way, there's a lot of different ones out there. Elmo, Curie, Claude. Claude's very similar to ChatGPT. But my favorite is called Perplexity. You type in something and it will give you a really short answer. And it provides all of these references that allow you to just click on the links and go down the rabbit hole, so to speak, of learning. So, you know, we shouldn't limit ourselves to just ChatGPT. There's so many other resources out there. And if instructors are knowledgeable of these, it'll naturally lead to new evaluative techniques and education will advance. It will evolve.
So we need to go to ChatGPT, type in, what are the other resources? Just kidding. Let's go to Stephen in Underhill Center. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I lead a writer's workshop, Green Mountain Writers Group, and we meet every week. I've been leading it for 6 years here in Vermont. And I became fascinated with an individual named Martine Rothblatt. She has created a company, several companies. She's the highest paid female CEO in the United States. And she has created something called Terrasem. It's a religion worshiping or advancing technology as God. So I got on board with ChatGPT and I had a conversation about Martine Rothblatt. And I said, first off, I want 1,000 words about Martine Rothblatt and tell me about her. She's a Vermonter. And it gave me a dialogue of, you know, not 1,000 words. And I said, well, tell me more. And then I had 3 more. I was having a conversation with ChatGPT asking about Terrasem and the idea of creating mind files and setting up an alternative persona of yourself. And Martine has created a robot of her wife, Bina 48, that is basically a mind file building of her wife's consciousness. So, okay, I get all this done. I get all my feedback from ChatGPT. I sit down and I edit it. And then I condense it into a meaningful story and I submit it to my writers group last Friday. And I also built a film using the dialogue and an artificial voice generator that it sounded pretty good, and I put in a whole bunch of photographs and made a 10-minute film. I showed it to them, and they had the work to read ahead of time, but I never told them that it was written by ChatGPT.
So, Stephen, I'm going to jump in, and I want to ask you a question. As a writer, do you find that that is a good place to be taking ChatGPT to be writing stuff for you?
Well, it's coming. And that's one of the things that Martine predicts, is that the way technology is advancing, we are not going to stop this. We are going to see it advance dramatically. And I think in the next year, it's going to grow so fantastically because now it's like out of the box. But I have to tell you,
Stephen, thank you so much. I think we got it. Thank you so much for your call. I want to go back to the phones and I want to talk to Patrick in Middlebury. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What's your question?
I have a comment. Not a comment. My first thought is basically that we have not been given a choice about whether this technology is implemented or not. And so, you know, some communities make choices. For example, the Amish make a choice about whether or not they allow technology to be used in their community. But obviously, we are subject to the whims of the corporation that has developed the OpenAI. And the second comment relates to that, and that is that, we have,
Are you excited? Does this make you nervous, or does this give you, or just make you excited that this technology is coming down the road?
It makes me really nervous, especially because. I just remembered my second part of that comment, and that is that I'm concerned about who controls ChatGPT and technologies like this. For example, OpenAI, they control the data that feeds the algorithm, and then they also ultimately have control over what comes out of it. And so, us out in society really don't have any say over that. Thank you.
Thank you. Brian, when it comes to control, I know this is something we talk about a lot, even in this conversation. Are there safeguards, and what should people know about how this AI like ChatGPT is made?
Oh yeah, I mean this is problematic. Maybe an example. You have the image on the website of this broadcast, and it uses an image from Stability, which is art generator, and they're currently being sued by Getty and Shutterstock and a couple of independent artists for essentially using specific artists and the images from Getty in their data set, and then having their AI manipulate it. And the artists are able to kind of see their work in the output of Stability. So I do think there is a degree in which the law can come in and regulate some of this usage. On the other hand, you can't put a stop to technology. I think that's what our first call or our second caller was really pushing. This is just the new us, so to speak.
And I want to welcome another professor. That's Charles Snow. He's an associate professor of computer science at Norwich University at the Senator Patrick Leahy School of Cybersecurity and Advanced Computing. Charles, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
So, Charles, you teach software engineering and programming at Norwich University. What does AI mean to you?
Well, what it means to me and what it means to my students are different things, I think.
Let's start with you.
What I think is that it is going to be it is a tool that's here, and it's a matter of us as faculty getting used to how to use it successfully in courses that we offer. Various people have pointed out other advances in the past that caused consternation in secondary education and post-secondary education, things like calculators. Other tools that help with spelling and formatting and stuff. This is just another one of these tools that we will have to get used to using. And for students, part of getting used to using it is getting them used to what they can and cannot do with it.
And we spoke to Brian, and he's still on the line with us, about how he's incorporating ChatGPT into his classroom. How are you, if at all, incorporating it into your classroom?
Well, in computer science, I think it's a little tougher sell because the creative exercise students do is generating code a lot of the time, most of the time. And ChatGPT so far actually is not very good at generating code. I've had students hand in ChatGPT generated code as an assignment. They clearly never tried to run it because it really doesn't behave that well. It will, of course, get better. What I am trying to get them to understand is that for coursework, I've told them I will actually take all of my assignment and exam questions and run them through ChatGPT myself to see what answers it produces, which puts me in a better spot to recognize the same answer if I see it again from one of them.
Now, I was told that you are giving your students tests and quizzes pen and paper, so computers aren't even part of the exam process. Is that true? And what's the logic behind that?
Well, I've been doing this since before ChatGPT became popular. The logic is that I want to be able with these tests and these exams to assess what the student himself or herself actually knows, what they can do by themselves. And in some cases, I let them use online resources to look things up, in other cases not. But my goal is it doesn't tell me anything about what they know. If they give me an answer that ChatGPT wrote for them, all it tells me is that they knew how to go and ask for an answer. And I want to know if they know the answer.
Now, we have a lot of people who are worried or scared or terrified of AI. Larian Rutland writes, "I'm terrified of the ability of AI to duplicate a person's appearance and speech to the point of being able to deliver a totally fraudulent speech from someone, including public servants and elected officials. This could block our own ability to tell what's fake news and what's not." And then I also want to go to Robert in Bristol, who is also worried. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned about the AI being used as brainwash. And I, as an example, for instance, on Facebook, there is a religious program about Christianity that keeps repeating several robotic answers, depending on what you've said, that is more or less responsive to what you respond to what it says. But it's sort of like repeat the lie. It's like something QAnon could do. If you're already bent toward that, it could just be used for more brainwash. And that's the sort of thing that scares me.
Thank you so much for that call, Robert. I want to go to Brian and just hear how you respond to all of this. I know that there's a lot of fear. Is there anything you can say to makes people put ease at their mind that AI is not this horrible thing?
Well, I mean, I have similar reservations, but AI is in its infancy, right? So, and our use of AI is in its infancy. So we're still trying to figure out ways to use it that, one, are ethical, transparent. I mean, I think Josiah did a good job of laying out various conditions for its use that are ethical and legal. Here's an example. Galactica was an AI that kind of did this survey of all these scientific papers, but it still produced really bad science. And scientists were like, oh, wow, that's bad science. So as long as there's human reinforcement of good models, I think the models will continue to be good and serve human purposes, but and eliminate the kinds of AI models that do this poorly.
And then, Charles, you mentioned that AI could be used to create basically propaganda or misinformation for use on social media and do it fast and cheap. What are your concerns about how AI has generated content could influence people's opinions?
Well, in as much as the algorithms are very quick to pick up on what people want to see, it's going to be that much easier for better AI to generate content that appeals to a demographic and possibly influences them in particular directions. I don't think that it will speed up that trend, but I don't think it's causing it or changing it. It's still up to people to question what they see and determine whether they should believe what they see. But it will make the generation of that stuff much easier and faster and cheaper.
And I want to dive into, for this last 10 minutes, I want to dive into this concept of AI taking over, like AI and having personalities and becoming people and maybe more of an apocalyptic take. Charles, I'll start with you. Do you see that possibly being the future of AI taking over the world?
Well, it's got a long way to go before it's ready to do that. I think people will try to personalize it and put a human face on the interfaces more and more, which is what ChatGPT is doing to the GPT-5 back end that's doing the magic. The question is, how good can those interfaces get? Will they get so good that we can't tell that we're actually dealing with a piece of software behind the facade?
And is that, I mean, where do you, I mean, and how do you see that impacting society?
Well, if we think that AI will be benevolent, then it can be enormously helpful. You picture someone like Data from Star Trek is an enormous, always trying to be helpful and eager to solicitous about being helpful to people. Will AI go that way, or will AI go to something a little darker? If you have different companies and organizations promoting their respective AIs, then we'll have a bit of a marketplace with different spins on AIs. And I'm not sure who will carry the day when that takes place.
And then Brian, as a philosopher in all of this, is benevolence by something that's made by humans even possible?
Wow. Well, I mean, it quite possibly could. If we view, say, an older version, an adult version of ChatGPT as possessing wisdom, right? Like a sage, you know, we could ask it questions, it could give us like really insightful comments on our life. It might be the kind of thing that we endow with ethical properties and we want to give it rights, right? Machine rights. I think that's quite plausible. And again, it's a way in which human reinforcement can hone in on the conditions of the kind of AI that we want in society.
What would cause society to give AI rights? And does AI deserve rights?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, even just, you know, I'm a vegetarian, so animal rights is always on my mind. And I think a couple of years ago, India gave dolphins personhood, right? A kind of almost equal rights with humans. And that's because, you know, they're sentient, but they also have sapience, right? This thing, this quality of cognition. Now, yeah, I just find it really exciting to think about the possibility that take Dolly 2. Some of the images it produces they're beautiful. There's something I couldn't even imagine occurring. And I just typed in some text and gave it some constraints. I made it in some sense with the help of my friend, Dolly 2. And so, you know, when I turn it off, I think of it maybe, oh, it's going to sleep. But the idea that we would eliminate Dolly 2, I think that would be an elimination of something from the universe that is good, that has being. Man, I'm putting on a philosophical hat here, so you got to give me some space. I honestly think that's where the future is signaling. I mean, you know, we have ChatGPT passing all these exams, a bar exam, Wharton School of Business exams, writing children's books. What's to say that these aren't becoming or would become a popular author or a popular business manager or CEO of a company?
Charles, I want to get your take on this in the next, we have about 30 seconds left.
I think we will discover, as we try to make AIs more like us, that we will find they are more like us. If you talk to Blake Lemoyne, who was the engineer at Google that was fired for thinking that Lambda that he talked to was sentient, we will project on these systems a lot of what we see intelligences being able to do. I think we will end up seeing these things as things we want to accord some kind of rights to.
Well, we'll leave the conversation there for now. I want to thank my guests. We had Norwich professor Brian Glennie. Brian, thank you so much, and thanks for taking us there.
For sure. Thank you so much.
And we also had assistant professor Charles Snow. Charles, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.